Good afternoon. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Listeners, today we invite your questions about computers. Computers and you, a topic we take up once a month on the third Monday of the month. Our guest this month, Peter Kimball. Peter is the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence, at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. The numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Peter, good to see you. Welcome back.
It's nice to be back.
Well, we've got a listener already lined up and ready to go, so let's go to that individual on line one. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. I have a question about the free software that's available, like Adaware and SpyBot. And currently what I'm running is I'm trying to run Adaware 2007, and in the past 2 weeks, every time I try to run it, when I say scan, it will say scanner is busy, and so I can't seem to be able to run that, and so I'm not exactly sure if that's indicative of some other problem. And I'm also running Spyware Doctor instead of SpyBot because I just thought I'd try something different. So the questions are, what recommendations do you have for like a daily, weekly kind of Adaware SpyBot kind of check?
Well, I'm not that familiar with the Spyware Doctor program. I can try to look it up here. But one thing you need to be a little bit cautious of, and not necessarily for this particular product, is some of them are just not very effective. And in the worst case, some of them are actually worse than the cure is worse than the disease, so to speak, because they have their own advertising. It's possible that depending on how they're doing this, there could be some slight conflict between the two programs. If you can't get Adaware to function, if it keeps saying that it is, the scanner is busy, are you able to bring up the Adaware control page? And it's just when you say, I would like to do a scan, that it says, sorry, I can't?
Right. It'll bring up an update page. You want to update the, any kind of updates. But the only updates it brings up are like different language ones, Flemish. And previously, it would run both of them. And I was before running Adaware and SpyBot, and then it was the Adaware that was the application that was before the newest one, and then it just wouldn't let me update at all until I went to this 2007. And so it just seems like it was just bringing up the same three cookies every time I ran it.
Right. And you are running, in addition to this, some virus protection software, I presume.
Yes.
So what I would try doing would be the Adaware and the SpyBot or the Spyware Doctor, are all useful programs to have, but they're not as essential as having antivirus software. So my first suggestion, if you can't get them to work, would be try totally removing those two programs, not your virus protection. Leave that in place.
Okay.
But just totally remove them. Probably the most effective way of doing it would be to go to the control panel, start settings on Windows control panel, add remove programs, and say you want to remove them entirely, both of them completely, restart the computer, and then go to the Adaware site, LavaSoft, and to whichever of the other ones. I would probably start with the Adaware site, download the new version, mm-hmm. get it up and running, make sure that it runs, that it's happy, that it will scan and do everything else for you, and then either choosing, I can't give any particular reference for the Spyware Doctor, but certainly for the SpyBot, try downloading the current version of that, seeing if it runs. Go back and see if your Adaware runs, and if it doesn't, there's an incompatibility between the two of them.
Okay.
Then you could try uninstalling the Spyware Doctor or the SpyBot. Make sure that Adaware hasn't gotten so confused by its mm-hmm. presence that it'll still be able to run, mm-hmm. and then try the other of the spyware programs. The other alternative, which is not quite as free, but it really depends upon which antivirus product you're running, is that many of the new ones from McAfee or from Norton, in addition to just antivirus for relatively few dollars more, have much of that same kind of functionality looking for advertising, malicious spyware sorts of things built into them.
Do you recommend either? Well, currently I'm using the AVG antivirus.
I've heard good things. I have not been running that on some of the systems that I work with. We're using Norton on others. Through the university, we're using McAfee because of a contract arrangement between the university and that company.
Okay.
I've never heard anything bad about AVG, but I can't tell you much more detail. I don't have any direct experience with it.
Okay. Now, if we do go to the Norton or McAfee, do you recommend the paid versions, or are they all paid versions?
They're all paid versions at that
point.
You can actually get the software relatively cheaply, often bundled with other software. And for those, as is probably the case with your AVG software, it doesn't end there because you need to have a subscription for the most recent and constantly changing virus types, what are called virus signatures, and that's generally when you first buy the software, you get perhaps a 1 year or maybe sometimes a 2 year subscription to that, and then that has to be renewed for 20, 30, whatever, some relatively modest amount of money, but not free.
Mm-hmm. So suppose someone was just starting fresh and hadn't tried anything, what would be your best recommendations for covering virus and spyware?
Probably one of the all-in-one packages is simply going to be simpler, depending on whether cost is an issue. So the Norton Internet Protection or the McAfee's equivalent, which the name of which escapes me right at the moment.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your help.
Good luck.
You're welcome. Bye. Next, we take a call on the toll-free line 4. Good afternoon.
I'm from Chicago.
Hi.
Please help. I have a laptop running XP SP2. And, about a month ago, it's when I try to shut down, it gives me a list, and I've counted them, of 15 different programs where it pops up a window. It says end program, and it
yes.
names a program, and I have a choice of end now or cancel. But almost every time, and I wish I could say that it's every time because in some weird way that would be comforting, but almost all the time I get all of these pop-ups. And I'm running it now as we speak, and it says the program is not responding, you know, click cancel to go to Windows and or end now and lose information. Of course, I didn't do anything when I booted up, so there's really nothing that I'm worried about losing, I don't think.
So
there's some way of overcoming that?
Well, it is basically telling you the name of these programs, and it says such and such a program is not responding. Do you want to end now or cancel? That's
right.
What are some of the names? Do you recognize any of the names? For example, sometimes with some software, if things have gotten a little bit strange, it might say things like Microsoft Word or a browser or an email program. Does it list anything by name that you recognize? When it says such and such a program is not responding or...
Is the listener still there? Well, I think we lost the listener.
Well, let me just mention a couple of things then, and perhaps the listener will be able to get in touch again. If any of these programs are recognizable, then which I gather in his case may not be so, because I got the implication that he just start up Windows, wouldn't start anything else, and these things would happen, which means they're automatically starting. So in that case, he could... go to the Start menu and type run and type winconfig, I believe, is what we would do. Although, again, I don't have the current version of Windows on this machine. We've talked about that before. And you can see which programs are actually being told to start up when Windows starts automatically without any intervention by the user. And it could well be that as a result of something he had done or something that had been installed in the past, there are several programs that are running some of which are necessary and others of which may not be, but he can actually go into what is called safe mode, booting up generally by pressing the F8 key as you start in Windows, and then you can start up without any of these add-ons running and see if the same problem happens then, and if it doesn't, then he can start adding these things back one at a time and see which one is giving, which ones are giving him a problem.
Okay, I understand that we have the listener on line four from Chicago back with us. Hi.
I think I'm back on. Do
you okay? Yeah,
yes, we
got gotcha.
You.
Yeah, I missed the most of what you said.
Oh, okay.
You have. I can download this and get it again, can't I?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, just okay. Go to our website.
Let me just say that. The thing I wanted to say is that most of the programs that are listed are mostly really obscure kinds of things. Like, for example, SYNTPENH.exe. I have no idea what that is.
SYNTPENH. SYNTENH.
Oh no! Once more. SYN.
Yes.
TP.
I'm sorry, was that a DP or a TP?
No, T is in Thomas.
Okay.
T is in Peter.
Uh-huh.
E-N-H dot E-X-E. That's the first one that comes up.
Says, and you're using this as on a laptop. That's something that comes along with the touchpad for a laptop computer.
Right.
So it sounds like it's legitimately there, but why it may well be that some driver or some portion of the software that should be starting up is not starting up properly, because that could leave a lot of these other processes, such as the touchpad tray icon, which is what this particular one is. And as you're probably aware, you can Google these and see what they're related to.
Right.
May not be functioning properly. So one of the possibilities then, in addition to starting up in safe mode, is to go to the device manager, which you can get by right-clicking on your...
Right, I know how to do
okay. And uninstall one of those. You can look at all the various devices, and for the touchpad, for example, since this is one of the problems, tell the device manager that you want to uninstall it, restart the machine. It will find that there's something that it needs to install. Let it, and you can also check and see if there are any more recent drivers for any of that. But it sounds like there was there any kind of an update that you had done prior to all of this starting?
You know, I load and unload programs and get updates from Windows and from Firefox all the time, but I can't associate that phenomenon with anything in particular.
Okay. Well, again, I would the other options, in addition to going into the device manager, which you might want to try first, is booting up into safe mode.
Right.
You then have the ability of seeing does everything come up and can you shut down successfully, and you can also then change the Windows configuration, the various startup files, and gradually increase the ones that you're allowing to start and see which ones cause problems.
Right. Okay.
It's kind of a time-consuming, thankless task because you have to keep rebooting the machine and then shutting it down and seeing where things cause difficulty. But that's the initial approach I would take.
Right. Well, thank you very much. And when I go into Device Manager, would it be best to do that in safe mode or just a regular boot up?
I would probably, it probably won't matter too much. Some of the devices aren't going to be installed if you're in safe mode. So I don't think it's really going to matter one way or the other.
Okay, great. Well, there are 15 of them, so it's going to take me a while.
Well, and you know, it might be a trigger. One of them, it could be a single problem that acted as the trigger for all of these.
Right, okay. Well, the first one, the touchpad, sounds like a great candidate, so
yeah.
I'll work on that.
Okay, good luck.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And an AVG user called in, and apparently the paid version of AVG includes anti-spyware.
Okay, good. I know a lot of the companies are certainly including the whole array of things, including anti-spyware, firewalls, and, of course, the basic antivirus as well.
Okay, let's take another call. A listener on line two. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you today?
Fine. How are you?
Good.
Good.
I just have a couple quick questions, I hope. First thing, I'm using Windows Personal Care, which is a free program that comes with a registry editor and so forth. Seems to be keeping Windows Vista working pretty well, but I'm just curious as to what else I'm getting into using it on a constant basis. And second question, I know you're not a fan of them, but can you talk a little more about offline or online storage services and particularly as it would amount to cloning my laptop, because this is my only computer at this point, which is a strange feeling for me, but I don't like walking around with not having a backup somewhere that I can trust.
Sure.
And then the last thing is kind of a little offbeat, I suppose, but I do a lot of work with color and so forth, and I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on how to find a color monitor where you can actually see what's going on. I can calibrate the thing, but every one is a little different, and when the light hits them a little differently, it's gotten really strange. In the old days, we had the old tubes and so forth. So those are my three questions, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Well, let's see. We have the online-offline storage question,
right,
the color monitor,
care.
And the personal care for maintaining Vista. And I gather the question with regard to personal care is there other things that it can be used for, as he's I'm not quite sure I picked up on exactly what the original question was about the personal care for Vista.
I think he was wondering if there's any concerns about it.
Well,
pros and cons.
In general, a lot of these things are designed, and I presume this is from Microsoft for Vista, and the basic concern with that is that if the tool gives you access, for example, to cleaning what's called the registry, which is the area that Windows, versions of Windows for years now have stored all of their internal instructions and connections, it is possible without, if you're not careful, to change the registry in such a way that you can't even boot the machine anymore, and it requires fairly major intervention to get the machine running. But for most of those, you're going to find that you'll be advised to back up the registry, which you can easily do if you're going to the registry editor. Those programs can be very useful to help clean up the registry. Programs that were installed and then uninstalled or that were updated may not always clean up after themselves as well as they should, and sometimes the little leavings that they haven't removed can eventually cause some problems or can at least cause a bit of a slowdown. And if there are more questions about that, we can get to it in a bit. The offline versus online storage, the listener was absolutely correct. You want to have enough backup of materials so that should the worst happen and the machine be stolen or that should just go up in a puff of smoke, that though it would be a major inconvenience, nothing permanent would be lost. There are a couple of ways of doing that, and the more common way up until fairly recently was you make sure that you've got copies of all of the documents, the email, major email folders, the photographs, sound files if you've got a whole lot of MP3s and such, and not worry so much about the operating system or the actual software you've installed, because presumably you can reinstall that from either the installation disks that came with it. It's probably on CD or DVDs, and that's often better. The other possibility is, if you've got enough space, is to back up absolutely everything. A couple of ways of doing that. One that has actually gotten fairly affordable now is to use an external hard drive. It can be plugged in by a USB or a FireWire connection. There are a couple of other options as well. Capacities of those have now gotten a single unit up to 1,000 gigabytes, which is also known as a terabyte, more than almost anybody is going to have storage on their main computer, let alone a laptop. Even a 500-gigabyte drive for only a couple hundred bucks could do that. You can certainly back up everything that way. You could simply, say, make a copy of the entire disk. That is not quite the same as having a clone of the disk. You'll have copied all the files, but you can't just copy those files back to a clean hard drive and have the machine bootable because of all of the various installation registry things that won't necessarily be connected properly in the returned version. So there are software packages available. Ghost is one, but there are others as well that actually are intended to make a downloadable, bootable version of your current software image so that if you transfer it using Ghost, all 300 or 400 megabytes, however much is on the drive, it restores your hard drive to exactly the same condition that it was before. So it's often used, for example, in computer labs here on campus where you want to be able to build everything without having to sit down manually at the computer and say, well, we've got to install this software and that software. So if you use Ghost or an equivalent program, it may take an hour or so before everything is transferred, but the machine is exactly as it was when you took that picture. In terms of doing it, offline storage, yes, all of those files that you created with Ghost or anything else could certainly be burned to DVD. They could be left onto on the external hard drive. I've started doing that. I've just got an external hard drive, and I'll back up onto it and then just kind of unplug it and leave it there and do it to another hard drive a month later and just kind of swap back in between them because they've gotten so affordable these days. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, it's a whole bunch of CDs or DVDs that I would have to burn. There are also online subscription services that you pay a monthly fee for that will give you off-site storage, maybe 10 gigabytes, 20 gigabytes, 50 gigabytes. You wouldn't do the complete backup of all software and everything there. That would just be too much space, but you could certainly keep all of your important, irreplaceable files in such a location, and they are very reliable. It's not cheap, but it's not that expensive, 20, 30, 40 bucks per month, maybe less depending on how much information you've got. And some computer firms, I know Dell has started doing this and a couple of others as well, has, if you buy a new machine, given you a one-year free subscription to have 20, 30, 40 gigabytes of offline, you know, off-site storage available. In terms of color, and then we'll try to get to some of these other calls, it is still the case, although maybe not much longer, that the most accurate color rendition is going to be with the old television-based CRT-type monitors. You can still get deeper blacks. There's not nearly as much of a problem with off-axis viewing, which is when you're looking at the screen from not straight ahead, but from 10 or 15 degrees to the left or the right, although better LCD computer monitors are now pretty good because of lenses they built into them, at looking at it a little bit off angle. But there are, in addition to doing the calibration, there are devices that are often referred to as spiders. If you really want to do this, it's a little handheld device. It's got a cable, connects to the computer, and you can move it over the screen, and it will measure the precise colors that you have at that position, so you can really precisely calibrate the screen. You could do that and just see how far away you are with an LCD panel, but there are some very good LCD panels that are very precise in colors, but they are not going to be the $100 and $200 LCD panels. They're going to be more like the $1,200 and $1,500 LCD panels. So if color is really critical, then it's like so many other things, you're going to get what you pay for.
It is the Afternoon Magazine, and this is the third Monday of the month, so computers and you, our topic this month. And our guest this month, Peter Kimball of the University of Illinois. Let's take another call, a listener on line one. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello, Peter. I have a comment for the listeners who called a few calls back about antivirus and anti-spyware. one comment that I would like to make is that many internet service providers provide an antivirus or an anti-spyware package or both for free as long as you remain a subscriber to their service. AOL, Mediacom, I believe, does, and I know that Insight did, and now Comcast also as well have packages that they offer for free for their subscribers.
Yes, that's a good point.
Yes, and in terms of the AVG, I find that many people prefer the AVG or one of its free counterparts simply because it is free. They don't want to have to pay an extra $25 or $30 a year to maintain that. And although they're quite good considering that they're free, they're not the best. If you look at the efficiency of those, and in terms of not only how much do they catch, and then also in terms of how much load does it put on your computer, they generally fall somewhere in the middle to bottom third of the rankings. So that's something to consider with that. And if they can get it free through their ISP, and it's usually a brand name. I know it's either McAfee or I believe one of them is Trend. It's a Trend Micro product as well.
Yes, that's also well known.
Yes, if they're a student or faculty or retired from the university, they're eligible to tap into your corporate your volume license for the universities.
Yes, which is McAfee software.
Yes, which is McAfee. So those are some free options for them as well. The last point I want to make is that a former colleague of yours, I believe, Eric Howes, is now working as a consultant for a company down in Florida, who I won't name because I don't want to plug any particular product, but there's a new product, and people can do a Google search on it, called Vipre, V-I-P-R-E, from a company down in Florida, Sunbelt Software, and it's currently in beta, so I can't give you a final definitive answer on it, but I've been testing it, and it's an integrated package as opposed to a layered package like McAfee or Norton, and very low footprint and very fast, at least in the beta so far. So that's another option that I think that's going to be coming online sometime in June.
And I'll just mention that Sunbelt is well known. In fact, I've subscribed to one of their listservs because they've got a lot of useful information.
Yes, they do, as do I. So anyway, that's all I have. And,
great. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the chat.
Thanks for the call. Next, we take a call from a listener on line 3. Hi.
Hi there. I had a question about just maybe some basic causes of fluctuations in speed of your internet connection. I have, I guess you call it high-speed cable, the Comcast.
Yes.
And a laptop that's wireless and running off Bluetooth, I guess. And it tends to go from, I think, 54 Mbps is the fastest it can run, but it shifts down to 24, and then it grinds down to as low as 1, and it just kind of goes through cycles where it fluctuates and really can't, takes forever for pages to load and that kind of thing. And I just didn't know if I should be looking at an issue with the computer itself or if it's something about the connection through the company that's servicing.
How are you coming up with these, determining the speeds? Is there are you running one of the programs that, or going to one of the websites that measures your download speed, or the numbers that you get?
I guess there's a little logo that shows the wireless connection, and that has a speed on it.
Okay. Well, any time that you're dealing with speed issues, there could be several places where a slowdown occurs. Since you're getting an indication of the speed in terms of the wireless connection, I'm going to guess that you're using probably it's the wireless kind of connection. It's not Bluetooth that you're using for actually connecting to the internet. That's more for connecting things like mice and keyboards to the computer wirelessly. But it's something that's, if you go by the numbers, it's called 802.11. And there are several flavors of that. There is 802.11b and A and G, and I would guess that you are using, with speeds that are up to maybe 54 megabits per second, the 802.11g, which is a relatively recent standard. But the problem with any of those is you have to be aware that they're like radio signals, and they travel almost any place. And so if somebody else, even in the neighborhood, has a wireless router which is using what is essentially the same channel, there can be some conflicts, which is perceived as a slowdown as the system has to resend the data several times before they get it right. I used to have this problem when a neighbor of ours added a new wireless router, and when it was on and they were using it, I would see that my wireless connection speed would drop by probably a factor of 10. And all I ended up doing was going into the setup for the wireless router, and there's a choice of various channels, not a huge range, but I switched it, for example, from channel 11 to channel 1 or to channel 6 or something, which worked pretty well for quite some time until, you know, some more people added their wireless connection. That's probably where the slowdown is. It is probably between your computer and the wireless router, since you're getting that information from, you know, that little icon, that little tray information thing, has almost nothing to do, therefore, with the speed of your cable connection, which, by the way, can also vary. And cable is a shared medium, which means in the late evening, middle to late evening, when there may be a lot of people downloading and such, overall, everybody's sharing the same amount of bandwidth, of capacity, and so everybody's individual share will go down a little bit, as opposed to, you know, 3 o'clock, well, maybe not 3 o'clock, but 8 o'clock in the morning when things may be much faster. But I suspect that the slowdown you're noticing is due to what are termed collisions with other people using wireless who happen to be on the same channel. And so you can find in the instructions of your wireless router, there will be some numeric address that you can type in your web browser. It'll be something like 192, you know, HTTP colon double slash, it'll tell you this, 192.170, whatever it might be. And that will, with a wired connection generally, you'll have to, you know, run a cable from the wireless router to your machine because it only wants to do this for wired connections, and you'll be able to make changes such as what channel should it be working on. That's most likely the difficulty. There's other possibilities with you know, things like microwave ovens being on, depending on which frequency you're using. So if it's only when if it's really slow when the microwave is on, or when somebody's using the cordless phone, that could also be an issue.
Okay, and if it's an issue of a neighborhood sort of a log jam because you have more traffic during a certain time of the day, are there ways around that for the company that services that?
Not really. When it gets too bad, what the company could do is they could establish another node and essentially split people onto another service node so that they would have their own set of bandwidth. But again, that's not likely to be the issue in your case because of the symptoms you're describing, and especially seeing you're not going to get information coming back to you that it's at different speeds if it's a problem from the cable on.
Okay.
The information you're getting that shows it's dropping down is most likely just from the wireless router saying, I'm not able to communicate any more quickly than this, presumably because
Okay.
of some conflicts.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Good luck.
You're very welcome. And let's take another call. A listener on line two. Hi, you're on the air with Peter Kimball.
Hello.
Hi.
There's been a bit of discussion about backing up. And for couple of months I've been using the backup that's built into XP. At least it's built into XP Pro.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be quite satisfactory. When I tried using the built-in software with, I believe it was Windows 98, I found that it wouldn't successfully back up to CDs. I think this would. It certainly works well with an external hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's there, so it's not expensive.
Right.
And the first time I use it, I do a complete backup, and then I simply do incrementals.
Uh-huh.
And
you do a complete backup every month or something like that then?
Well, I ended up with three of these external drives. I thought one had gone dead, and then I found that it was a power source, and it actually works well.
Uh-huh.
I keep a couple of them in the safety deposit box at the bank,
okay,
just to get them off the, you know, out of the local area.
Right.
And I have two backups on each. That is, I have essentially what I've got is six backups all told.
Okay.
On the three drives. And then I do an full backup, and then I do incremental backups for a week or two until I exchange the drives.
Sounds like you'd be very well covered. I couldn't suggest anything really more comprehensive. And the Windows Backup Program, it may not be as flexible as some add-on, fairly high-end programs, but it certainly does the basics. It allows you to back up your various documents. You can choose to back up, you know, all the information on this computer, which I gather is what you're doing periodically.
Yeah.
And so, yes, you should be in good shape. There is, it would be good on occasion to just sort of test one of those recent backups with a file that's not that important and make sure that you really can get it back from the disk. You almost certainly can, but there are the horror stories about somebody who was making regular backups and then the disaster happened and they discovered that their backups weren't readable. Going to a hard drive, however, an external hard drive, that's much less likely. The problem that that has come up in the past were with people backing up to tape and not realizing that these special tape drives were not doing their job. But you are in excellent condition. In fact, having the other ones in the safe deposit box is probably about as far as you go in terms of backing it up. What I'll do is typically, you know, just I've got to deal with a neighbor and we'll just kind of exchange these things, but that clearly would not take care of a giant neighborhood tornado or something. So you should be in good shape.
Good shape. Okay. I want to thank the listener for his call. I've got another caller waiting to talk with us, and I also have a call that came in from a listener who can't be with us by phone this afternoon, and this individual has a request. Peter, would you offer us a little bit of information about best choices in a computer for an individual who is an older person and either has yet to use a computer or very little experience?
All right. I presume that the need for the computer would be used primarily for email and for surfing the web. And so with very little computer experience, there are basically a couple of things to decide upon. One is the question, should you go with a Windows computer or mm-hmm. should you go with a Macintosh? The Macintosh is generally regarded as a bit simpler to start using, a bit less intimidating. There are fewer decisions that have to be made. The downside is that for a given level of performance, the Macintosh is generally noticeably more expensive. And Windows could work as well. The second decision that would have to be made is to go with a laptop, which gives you some portability, or to go with a standard desktop with a separate standalone screen and the keyboard and such. Again, there's a price difference for any model, whether it's the Macintosh or a Windows machine. It's going to be less expensive if you have the desktop, because having everything miniaturized and conveniently in a smaller case, as in the case of a laptop, is going to cost more. But the software or the experience will be the same on either one. There's a related question to that, and that is, especially for a number of folks who are not in their 20s or 30s, the issue of vision and how large text and such needs mm-hmm. to be able to read it easily. Laptops come with very large screens, but they get pretty expensive at that rate. It's much more affordable to have a relatively large screen for a desktop system. And with a larger screen, you can easily set the system up so that it will show text and anything else in a larger size, a larger font size. So ranging from the most affordable to the... you know, a little bit more elegant would be the most affordable would be an introductory Windows system, desktop system with a good size monitor. Then probably would come the Macintosh, not a lot more, but noticeably more for the same capability and the same size screen. Then if you want to be able to move this from place to place or take it with you more conveniently than a desktop, we move into the laptops. And whichever way out you go, the question of screen size needs to be addressed. And for laptops, larger screens can make the machine quite a bit more expensive.
Okay, and I would also suspect that keyboard comfort might be an issue.
Keyboard is something to try. In any case, when you're doing this, it would be good to go to one retail outlet, to the Apple Store, if you're looking at a Macintosh, or one of the big box stores or elsewhere, and actually look at it, try typing. The sales staff will certainly be able to set up something where you could just do a little bit of even hunt and peck typing and just see how comfortable it is as you're using the keyboard and looking at the screen. Definitely better than just buying it sight unseen over the internet.
Okay. Let's hope that helps as a good starting point for that individual. And now we're going to take another call. A listener on line one. Good afternoon.
I'm running XP Pro. Last Friday, I wanted to find a certain document. I was in a hurry. I was stressed. So it wasn't where I thought it should be, where it was supposed to be. And I started to wonder if I had, in fact, ever filed it at all. So I started doing a search. So I typed the first letter of the title of the document, and in the little box underneath, the whole title of the document appeared. So I thought, all right, I'll just click this, it'll come right up, and I'll be on my way.
Okay.
A while back, I watched a six-year-old girl torment her little sister by holding right in front of the sister's nose something she wanted and then snatching it away when she reached for it. And now I know how that little girl felt.
Oh.
I clicked search. It ran through the whole thing. It said we can't find it. I refined my search. I put in, a key phrase. It came up with the key phrase. It has never come up with it.
Okay, well, so when you, and this is just using the standard Windows search, like start, find,
yes,
files, etc. The fact that it came up with the actual name is a little bit misleading. It's just remembered that at some point you had searched for that before. Doesn't mean that it found it. It's sort of like in a web browser, when you start to type an address, it can sort of fill in the rest of it because it remembers something else you had typed. When you were doing the search, and you were giving it for folders or files named, what do you know about the name of the file? Do you recall the name of the file with pretty good accuracy? What it was saved
when
under?
When you say file,
like when you save it as mydocument.doc or annualreport.something?
Yeah, I know. I'm very confident that I have the title correctly. Is that what you're asking?
Well, it's not so much the title of the document, but it's the file name, what you would click on when you are opening it.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I'm confident of that, too.
All right. So what you might want to do is try not to search for too many things at once, because if you're even slightly misremembering one of those, it won't find it. So I would go back to the search for files or folders, specify maybe even just part of the name that would be unique, such as if it's annual report, maybe just put ANN and then an asterisk, meaning and everything else that matches this. You can get more specific if you wish, but this way it'll find, you know, if you actually accidentally call it annual space report versus annual report all run together, you'd include all of those. In the other search options, you'll also, and I suspect that this is standard, want to set it so that it's going to be searching for subdirectories. That's probably already the way it is. But don't, at the same time, unless you're really wanting to refine the search, say you want to look for things named such and such and also containing text. If you can go with the actual name of the document, that is a much faster search because it only has to look at the file names and doesn't have to open them up and look inside for particular phrases.
Okay, I get a sense of that.
And what you're doing by putting in the asterisk is essentially a wildcard character. So if you were to type something like ANN asterisk, you'd be looking for anything that started with those letters, even if it was something about somebody named Ann. If you know that it is a word processing document and you know that it is that you're just accepting the standard names, for example, and it ends with a period doc, D-O-C, you could actually type a little bit further, A-N-N, as an example, A-N-N asterisk period doc to find all files that end with the extension doc as in a Microsoft Word document that start with letters A-N-N, no matter how many letters or what letters they have after that.
Okay.
You may, depending upon how much of if you just type something like A and an asterisk, you may well have hundreds of files. So the other thing you can do, if you also know the date or approximate range of date that the last time you saved it, one of the other search options is to specify the date such as it was changed within the last, 6 months or 9 months, or it was, you'll have various options there. The catch with any of these searches is to not over-qualify it so you don't find it.
Okay, I understand that.
Okay.
While we've been speaking, I've typed in the first two words of the title and then an asterisk, and now it's saying searching for all documents limited to files containing the words and the first two words and then the asterisk.
Yes, but the asterisk means assuming that you, and this was under the search for files name. This was not under the containing text box, right?
I don't remember containing text.
Okay.
I'll stop and go back to that.
But essentially, you want to fill that in where it says, and I think you probably already had search for files or folders named, and that's where you type this with the asterisk. And the fact that it says searching for anything that starts with ANN asterisk, that's fine. It's just saying, that's the... you can actually do a quick run against that and see what will happen if you just put like the first two or three letters with an asterisk and let it run. You'll see it starts listing hundreds of files. Then you can stop it. And,
okay.
And that'll get you more comfortable with the way that wildcard search works. So it's a trade-off. You want to be as specific as you can to look, to have the search happen faster, but not so specific that you've overqualified and it doesn't happen to find it because maybe the name was slightly changed or maybe it inadvertently got saved under a slightly different name.
Okay. All right. Okay. I'm trying it.
Okay.
Hopefully I'll get it.
Good luck. The wild card should help.
Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
You're very welcome. We are out of time.
Holy cow,
Peter
that time Kimmel. Flew past.
It sure did. And I have a follow-up question somebody wanted to ask. I'll put that in my folder for next time.
All right, sounds
we'll
good.
We'll work on that, and we've got some other things to talk about next time as well. And I did my best trying to keep everybody rolling along and manage those calls. So,
lots of questions. That's good.
Listeners should remember that this is a topic we take up once a month on the third Monday of the month, and our thanks this month to Peter Kimball. He is the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois.